Well, of course, many of you who have listened to this program over the years know the name John Mack, the late Dr. John Mack, expert in alien abductions. Up next, Thomas Stryker joins us. He was a student of Dr. John Mack. We'll talk about SETI and some other things as we talk about extraplanetary experiences next on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie. Let me tell you a little bit about Thomas James Stryker, PhD, student of Dr. John Mack, of course, earned his doctorate in psychology from Saybrook University, founder, director of the Divine Spark, a not-for-profit organization dedicated to helping people through free meals and other means to help activate that spark within each of them. Welcome to Coast, Thomas. How are you?
Hey, I'm doing good. Thank you, George. I really look at it as a privilege to be able to be on your show.
Likewise. Hey, take a few moments. Tell me about Divine Spark. I find this fascinating.
Well, you do. Well, thanks for mentioning it.
Sure.
Divine Spark was a nonprofit that I started back over 10 years ago. It started with my interest in spirituality. It took me out to Minnesota to start working with a shaman and his wife. They were teaching Native American spirituality. So I went to a couple of those workshops, and I was very impressed by the information that I received there. So I asked him if I could possibly meet with him out where he lives. And he said, yeah, sure. I live on the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation in South Dakota. So I knew nothing about that reservation. I knew it was a large reservation. I knew it was mostly populated by Lakota Sioux Native Americans.
Uh-huh.
So I went out there back in about 2000, and it was enlightening. At the same time, it was depressing. I was appalled at the conditions a lot of the natives were living under there. You know, leaky roofs, black mold, you know, these broken down shacks. And,
oh, sure.
Yeah, just really, I'm sure a lot of people know the history of.
It's like, like Jamaica, like those little huts that you see.
Well, these are more like mobile homes, you know, very thin mobile homes, you know, in below zero weather, you know, so they're having a hard time just staying warm. So that created a huge impression on me. At the same time, as I got to talk with some of the medicine people, you know, I was just impressed by their spiritual resilience and how they could survive what they've been going through. So I came back to California, back home, and I was talking with a friend of mine who's an attorney. I said, you know, I really want to do something out there. I'm not really quite certain what to do, but I want to start doing my life work. I call it my life work back there. And so attorney friend of mine said, well, I think you should start a nonprofit. You can start getting some donations. You can help those people, you know. So that's what we did. We started up the nonprofit Divine Spark based on that everyone has a Divine Spark.
Mm-hmm.
And the work started out in Pine Ridge. Soon after, we started taking supplies out there.
Well,
and
good
this
for
is
you.
Being of service to the Native Americans. And,
good for you.
Yeah.
Well, tell me about the transition for you then, you know, and that, by the way, is extremely admirable. I wish more people would do what you do.
Oh,
how
thanks.
Did you,
how, I think a lot
how
of
did,
people are, yeah.
How did you end up interested in you know, alien-human contact?
Well, that's always been my passion since I was a young child because I was an early experiencer. So I was always interested in that aspect of other beings, you know, other life in the universe. You know, I never... You know, I was brought up in parochial schools, went to Catholic schools, and even lived with a priest one summer vacation. I think my parents wanted me to become a Jesuit priest, but I just couldn't get into the Bible studies as much because they were proselytizing that, you know, Earth was the center of the universe, and there weren't extraterrestrials. So I had a real difficult time growing up in the family that I was growing up in, but I was having different types of experiences that I couldn't really talk to my parents about. So you know, I just kind of held these in for many, many years, and trying to assimilate them was very difficult without proper guidance. So it took years for me to work through these experiences, but they were always there. I just didn't know what to do with them. And so I pretty much stayed in the closet with it, but it was always there, and I waited for the time that I could start approaching this with other people that may have had similar type experiences.
What a shame.
Yeah, well.
Losing John Mack, huh?
Oh, yeah. Depressed. I was very depressed when that happened. I was actually in Austria at the time when I heard about John's fatal accident.
Ah.
And I was in shock. I just was in shock. We were just starting to gain rapport, and you know, we were starting to email and, you know, getting closer. And, you know, he was always my mentor. I was nowhere near, you know, the level he was at. But I thought he was an excellent mentor, and he was very personable. What I mean by that, he is a real easy guy to talk with, because I think that's why he was so good at what he did. He could resonate really well with people, you know, especially over these type of topics, you know, extraterrestrials, yeah, UFOs, and things like that.
A lot of people had called the show during that period, Thomas, and they, you know, thought it was a conspiracy that government got John Mack because of his work, and he just got killed by a drunk driver.
You know, that's hard for me to believe also, because John was so conscious of everything. You know, he's that kind of guy. He's just alert, conscious, you know. And when I heard killed by a drunk driver, I was crossing the street. You know, that doesn't sound like John, you know.
No, it didn't.
No, but I had to put it away and aside because, you know, I needed to continue the work. And I still felt John was with me, even though he was deceased, you know, and, you know, that's kind of hard to explain, but I really felt he was still, and still to this day, of a companion that's helping me get through these challenging topics and, you know, trying to go beyond consensus reality and dominant worldview, which he wanted me to do.
Well, I miss him. I miss him because there aren't a lot of PhD types that are out there that devote some time to this field. And he was one of the best. And shortly after he died, Thomas, we lost Bud Hopkins.
Yes.
Who was another great abductee researcher. And so, you know, it's good to know that there's still people like you that are in this, that are coming along, because it's very difficult to replace the John Macks of life.
Yeah, we really can't really replace him, but we just try to do our best to, you know, carry on the work is how I look at it. You know, John was just one of those guys that, now here I am, you know, a struggling graduate student, you know, in a topic that my school didn't really want. But they said, if you can get John Mack on your dissertation committee, you can do this study. So, you know, I was lucky and fortunate enough to get John, you know, and he signed on.
That's great.
Yeah.
And your direction of your study took you where?
The direction of my study, I mean, the dissertation topic of, mm-hmm, you know, basically trying to interview people that I believed had experiences on other planets. You know, that took me to where I am today, you know, with turned the dissertation into a book called Extraplanetary Experiences, Alien-Human Contact and Expansion of Consciousness. So I'm continuing the work of working with individuals who claim to have reports, you know, of going and visiting other planets, stars, or moons.
Well, let's get into that now and this work. As you did this dissertation, which turned into, as you said, the book Extraplanetary Experiences, were you shocked with anything, Thomas?
Yes. You know, I think I was shocked that there were a lot of other people that were, you know, secretly in the closet with the experience also, like I was. So it was a real eye-opener. It was like it was meant to be. This was the work I needed to do. And it was shocking to find out that people did not want to really work through the situations, you know, in ways that they prefer to be anonymous, actually. And they didn't want to be known as, you know, psychotic or however the prevailing establishment might want to psychodiagnose them, you know, because they've gone through a lot of that through most of their life. So it was a coming out for a lot of these. I know I interviewed probably hundreds of people, you know, and I finally got a hold of some people that said, no, I'm through all that. You know, I've been working on these experiences or still involved in these experiences for the last 30 years. Now, in my book, all the interviewees are over 50 years old. You know, they've assimilated their experience quite well, you know, but it took that long, you know, to get to that point where they're actually have the courage and strength to talk about it in a way that they're not afraid of being criticized any longer.
Let us get into some of your work here, Thomas. What is XPE, extraplanetary experience? What is that?
Well, okay, extraplanetary experience is the term I created. I wanted to create a new term for psychology so that we could study this a little bit more directly. And like I said before, you know, an XPE is a reported experience by individuals claiming that they have visited another planet, star, or moon. Now, we can look at this in the physical sense. And let's take a look at Edgar Mitchell, for instance, the astronaut.
Apollo 14.
Right. You know, and I think by now most of us do believe that we went to the moon and these people have gone out and walked on the moon. So I put Edgar in there, one of the first interviews, so people could get a real concrete, physical example of what I'm talking about as an extraplanetary experience, because I think Edgar Mitchell had that. And the way that he had it was he went up in a U.S. spacecraft, you know, and he went to the moon, he got out, he walked around the moon a little bit and experienced what it was like to be on another world, and then came back. You know, the really important message that Edgar had to offer was on the way back, you know, was the what he called the Samadhi experience. And so we entitled his interview the Apollo Samadhi, because he's still trying to unravel the mystery of it all. You know, now that it's all over, said and done with, and he's approaching 80 years old, he's still trying to unravel this experience. He doesn't have all the answers. You know, it's a mystery. And, you know, maybe that's just a part of the XPE, is the mystery that's still behind it. It kind of gives it a flavor. You know, it carved this person out, you know, you might say, from this experience. And experience to me, you know, I just want to put this up front, is like one of the highest authorities, you know, is to have your own experience. You know, no other person's ideas or sometimes not even your own ideas, you know, is the authority for the experience. So it's a really important part that I look at when I talk with people. And, you know, I think I learned that from John and his witnessing techniques. You know, when I talk to people about this type of experience, you know, I really try to use something called sympathetic resonance, meaning I really try to go deep into what they're trying to tell me. Although they may not be all that articulate about it, there's something about it that catches me, okay? The way they're saying it, the words they're using, and there's always a mystery involved in it. You know, so I just kind of like glue onto that. And I just, you know, try to pull out these particular themes that I'm looking for. And that's what I did in the book, the themes, you know, the mysterious parts of the experience.
Were you looking at primarily, Thomas, people who were abducted or people who had this kind of extrasensory telepathy experience with what could be ETs?
Yeah, I have to put up front, too, I was not looking for alien abduction experiences. Now, that's a whole other different phenomenon.
That
would take
Matt.
Another show entirely, okay?
Yeah.
So I was not looking for the alien abduction phenomenon. I was looking for people that actually felt they had that experience, and it wasn't in a abducting way, you know, taken by force. No, it wasn't part of that at all. These people, you know, most of the people were invited, you know, by extraterrestrials. It was more of a positive experience with benevolent beings that wanted to show these people their world.
Okay. Now, how did you find them?
Well, you know, that's a good question also. You know, I really just put it out to the universe like I do with a lot of things. You know, you put an idea out, you know, just in your own mind. You know, you say, well, you know, I really want to study this. And you make an intention, you know, to the cosmos, and you let it go. That's how it started for me. I know that sounds a little ridiculous, but then there's also the concrete parts of calling around, going to newspapers, going to UFO symposiums, workshops, and other extraterrestrial researchers was a big one for me.
All right, tell me a little bit more about that. As you go out there, were the people receptive to you?
When you're talking about the extraterrestrial researchers? Or
yes, or anybody. Because, you know, a lot of researchers and a lot of people clam up a lot. They just, you know, they don't want to say anything.
Well, see, I built rapport with extraterrestrial researchers through the years, you know, and I was working with them throughout the U.S. And, you know, I also went out to Europe and was working out there. And I was, you know, even stopped and, you know, was trying to work with Billy Meyer out there. So these are, you know, just came with the experience. I said I put it out there in the beginning to try and understand this experience at a deeper level. Please help, you know, and the help came. I was able to make some really good contacts. And, of course, I honored all those contacts. And that's just the same way that, you know, my nonprofit got started, you know, Divine Spark, by honoring, you know, our ancestors, you know, if you will, our Native American ancestors, and going in there humbly and asking, hey, what can I do, you know, to help? And I think I took a humble approach with these researchers. You know, a lot of them had a lot more credentials than I had, and a lot more experience And, you know, they had a lot of books out and things like that, so they were published. So I just went in humbly and asked, you know, I'm trying to search this phenomenon. I know it sounds a little strange right now, but if there's something here that I need to identify, define, and hopefully it'll catch on. And they were receptive to it. They thought, you know, that's a good idea. You got a good idea there. Of course, you know, I'll try to help you as much as I can. So I think that they seen something that they liked, you know, and what I was researching. So they wanted to help. They seen a graduate student trying to do some work that could benefit others. And, you know, it wasn't according to what prevailing consensus reality was saying about it. And I think a lot of good researchers are like that because they know that a lot of this work is underground activity.
Mm-hmm. It sure is.
You know, because there's no money in it. If you're going against consensus reality, the money's in the status quo stuff, you know.
So for some of these contactees, did they explain how the contact occurred?
Well, sure. Yeah, they all go into on the contactees. They all talk about their early time. Most of it was childhood, and then, you know, it was a process of continued contact throughout their life. So yeah, these, you know, and this, like I said before, you know, I really want to, you know, really emphasize the word assimilation, because it was a process for them. It wasn't like, well, they had this one experience and it changed their world, and they were able to articulate it right away exactly what it was about. And it took a long process of years of working through this, you know. And some people even thought in the beginning that they were abducted, but after they worked through the experience, they realized, no, I wasn't abducted. I was just scared. I was scared of these beings, and I felt I was being abducted. And, you know, when you work with experiences, you know, of this nature, the stories change the more you work with them.
Well, they do. And I mean, in your case, as a researcher, you want to believe them, but you also have to take that middle ground. Were there times you would roll your eyes, Thomas?
Oh, yeah, there's a lot of people. I just said, oh, sorry, I can't use your report right now. You know, can we meet again at another time?
So you didn't believe them?
Well, in a sense, I wasn't I don't want to say I didn't believe them. I just didn't resonate with what they were saying, because they couldn't really tell me. You know, I was really searching for the life-changing events from the experience. And a lot of the people could not articulate that. And so there was something there that was missing yet, because it was still maybe too fresh, or there's a possibility that they could have been fantasy prone and, you know, just made it up. It's possible. You know, people do that.
Was there a common denominator among the people who have had this experience?
Yeah, of course. You know, that's what I bring out in the book. I call those the common themes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, and what is that denominator?
Well, there's 22.
22 of them, really?
Okay. Yeah, there was a lot of common themes. You know, you can imagine I had at least an hour and a half interviews with each one of these people, and then I transcribed all that material. So I had, you know, at least 20 to 30 pages of questions and answers in front of me. So I had to, you know, I just scrutinized all those and went through them and highlighted, you know, with highlighting pens, you know, pink, yellow, red, orange, important themes that I could, that just struck me as I was reading them. And I just read each one of them, and then I looked at all of them together and I says, wow, look at that. I got, you know, a lot of pink themes here, which means that they had a positive experience. It wasn't a negative experience. Okay,
well, that's interesting.
One.
Hold on, Thomas. We're going to hit this quick break. We'll come back with more here with our guest, Thomas James Stryker. His work, Extraplanetary Experiences, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Well, next hour, we'll take your phone calls with Thomas Stryker as we talk about his work, Extraplanetary Experiences. And we'll be back with more in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Hey, Thomas, welcome back. We're talking, of course, about your work, Extraplanetary Experiences. We were talking about some of those common denominators that these people have, and let's go back and refresh a little bit. So what are they?
All right, let's go over a few of them. First of all, every participant was able to articulate a deep, rich, and meaningful narrative, and that's what I was looking for. I wanted somebody that could really express what happened to them on their experience. More importantly, these participants, all of them, These common themes are, they ran through all the participants, that they believe other intelligent life forms exist in our universe and that they are presently visiting the Earth. Now, that includes Edgar. Edgar states, "Oh, I have no doubt about it. The fact is that we have been visited, and the whole UFO phenomenon, we have been visited." So I wanted to make that noteworthy there. All participants experienced seeing or being inside a spacecraft. All participants indicated that they had seen landscapes, and each described what the ground looked like at the place he or she visited. Some of the other themes were people reported new attitudes about themselves and the world they live in because of this. You know,
they felt better, didn't they?
They felt better with themselves, and they felt more intelligent. You know, like they had an experience that opened them up to a new realm of reality. All participants described a change in consciousness. And this is interesting, too. All participants noted their desire to be of service to help humanity. And all participants reported utilizing ESP, such as telepathy, during their experience. All participants indicated their gut feelings evoked intuitive information. You know, so they were coming from, you know, what could be considered psychic levels of intuition. All participants reported greater enhancement and connection with humanity. All participants reported the concern with the material things of life changed as a result of this experience.
So truly a life-changing and altering experience.
Right. So there's a lot of these changes that, you know, that they experienced, and I think that's important to bring out.
Do they all say that these ET contacts, Thomas, originated within this universe, within this galaxy, or did they talk about the multiverse, other dimensions?
Well, you know, that's a good point, because some of them couldn't really articulate exactly, and some of them weren't told where they were taken. You know, that's the other part, you know, and some thought, like Richard said, he was never told. Marilyn said she went to Alpha Centauri. Edgar, of course, went to our moon. Gary went to Mars, you know, on and on. So as you know, I think that's a difficult part of the assimilation. You know, people get asked that question all the time, you know, and I'm not really all that concerned about where they went. You know, like I said before, I'm really concerned about the effects they had from this experience and how it changed their life. So I'm not on there. I need to know exactly where this is, you know, what constellation, what galaxy, you know. No, I don't do that. I could do that more possibly in the sequel. But like I said, my intentions are different.
Okay, so you don't know, for example, if the contact is being done through one planetary system out there in the universe or where it might be.
No, I don't. But I look at that as all being connected, you know, if it's, you know, what part of the cosmos, you know. I mean, the way I look at the universe or the cosmos is that it's endless. There is no limit to the cosmos. Okay, we don't have that yet, and maybe we never will. So I think that there's places out there we haven't defined yet, because there's no limit. It's unlimited.
Do these people feel as if government can't control them anymore since they've had these experiences?
You know, it's interesting when you use the word government, so I want to just kind of lay that out straight if we could, you know, because the way I look at government, you know, people say, oh, our government. So I look at government as in America as our major corporations.
I agree.
Okay.
Those,
so if we could get
those,
that straight.
Or those, the greedy Illuminati.
Yeah. You know, they're holding, if you will, you know, the keys, you know, and so. Because everybody likes to blame the government, you know, but we're taking part in supporting the people that we're having problems with right now, you know, the major corporations. We support a lot of their products, you know, and we support a lot of their behaviors. So what I'm trying to get at here is that I think these people understand that also. And I think they're beyond that. You know, they're not so tied up in that, if you will, control of world power, which, you know, is of course going on. They're in some ways rising above that.
Well, that's true. They're becoming better
consciousness because these Illuminati, whoever you want to call these people that are in power, you know, who's to say they're very conscious?
Are they becoming better people?
What I mean is, how conscious are they of a living cosmos?
True.
When they could be totally focused on material possessions on this planet, you know, which is very limiting and restricting.
Are they in constant contact with whoever they've been contacting with?
Some are in constant contact, like Marilyn. She can just directly go. You can be talking to her, and she'll just, you know, go right into, you know, a channel or go into communicating with the ascended masters, she calls them.
Thomas, did any of these people talk about the future of this planet, anything that could be helpful to us?
Well, of course. You know, they all had messages for humankind. You know, a really important part of the book covers that. You know, what are these important messages? And it all has to do with, yes, they're all concerned. They're concerned that, you know, we're basically destroying the Earth, and we got to do something about it now, you know, not later. And they're basically, the other messages have to do with, we need to get in touch with these beings now, not later, and they can help us. Instead of going with this fear that, you know, if we look at the Star Wars or, you know, the violent side of how extraterrestrials can be depicted, you know, that we're going to lose out.
Well, you may be right about that, too. We may have lost out already, Thomas.
It says, like Norma says in here, she says, let's get on with this. Let's now move into these higher worlds with these other beings and start enjoying another way of life.
All right, and one of the things we wanted to talk with you about tonight is your views, of course, from SETI, Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. You've got some thoughts on this. Tell me about it.
Well, you know, I never worked very closely with SETI. I tried back in my graduate years. I was out in Palo Alto, and I stopped at a NASA plant. I just said, you guys are trying to communicate with extraterrestrials in a way that's not going to be conducive to overall success. And they just kind of laughed at me, like, who do you think you are? But, you know, what it really comes down to after all this time is that, you know, SETI, what they tell us is that they really didn't accomplish what they were going to, what they were trying to accomplish. And they were trying to accomplish, you know, trying to communicate with extraterrestrial beings out there in the universe somewhere. Well, they were trying to use radio transmissions, okay? And that's like saying, you know, let's call up, you know, Mike over there on Mars right now and see if we can have a little conversation with him. You know, it's not, it never has worked that way. It's, at least in my experience in working with this phenomenon and the people that have had contact, it's always been telepathic. What I mean by that, of course, is mind-to-mind communication. So in that sense, what I'm trying to say is a little bit more intimate than how SETI was trying to gain access to this.
Now, see, I find this fascinating because here's SETI spending a lot of money, donated money, of course, primarily, to try to communicate via radio waves. And then we have all these other people communicating instantly at minimal cost.
There you go. But there's a genuine desire there. You see the difference? And that's, it's, this is beyond money. I mean, money has a lot to do with, this is how, you know, we're going to go back to the Illuminati or the ruling world order. You know, it comes down to those material possessions, and we fall into that. You know, all of us have at some point in our lives. But that's not what's going to make this work. I think that, you know, this is where, you know, if we get a chance to talk about this, where the inner work comes in, which all these participants have done. They've done their inner work. They've spent a lot of time with themselves trying to assimilate their experience, but they know their experience was very important to them. And they know it didn't fall into consensus reality. then they and they received a lot of, you know, terrible remarks about some of their beliefs. But they stuck to it despite criticism from the ruling class, popular opinion, or mainstream science. And, you know, these people, I think, are the people that are going to change this. This notion about how we are so engrossed in material possessions, money being one of them, and what we can gain on this planet. And the things that are the most important are going to be the things that aren't going to cost anything. It's going to have to do with our evolvement into higher psychic abilities, if you will, you know, beyond our five senses. And everybody has this ability.
Thomas, you talk about these experiences as being almost like near-death experiences. Tell me more.
Well, of course, you know, there's parallels with the extraplanetary experience and the near-death experience. One being some of the things I mentioned, usually ends up to be a positive experience once the person gets through it. You know, it can't be painful, but at the end of it's all said and done, there was something that was gained. The near-death experience, you know, also brought about less fear of death, or maybe no fear of death, because they believe they actually went through a death experience, you know, through the experience. Same thing with what I'm calling the XPE. There was a part of them that died off, you might say, their old self, you know, like, you know, just getting rid of old worldview, old judgments, belief systems, and seeing things for how they are through their new experience. You know, these are big parallels, I think. And, you know, there's, you know, 20 parallels, maybe more than that, between the extraplanetary experience and the near-death experience. We have to realize that with both of these experiences, we're talking about the potential of us being more than the physical body.
Right.
Because you're aware, as a near-death experience, you're basically coming out of your body. You're having an out-of-body experience. Most people report, you know, if they're on the operating table or if they had an accident, they're out of their body, looking at their body, laying on the ground or on the table or on the operating table or wherever they may be. Now, what part of that are we going to call us or a part of us? You know, we can call it the psychic, the spirit, the mind. What separates from the body and it can be rejoined? Now we're going into death issues. You know, like all of us are going to face, inevitably, death.
No doubt.
We're going to be separated from our body. Now, a lot of people think that's it. It's over. It's done. You know, put me 6 feet under. I have nothing else to do. Now, there's other people that believe differently, and I'm sure you've had them on your show, that believe there's a part of us that lives on past that physical dimension. And there's different words for it. You know, using one, the mind, you know, the psyche, the spirit, the soul that lives past this. And some people can come back to report about it. You know, you've heard of past life experiences and near-death experiences, out-of-body experiences. So this is that parallel also that we're picking up with the extraplanetary experience, that this other dimension. You know, that
well, these contactees, though, primarily, if not all, got contacted via consciousness as opposed to something physical, I take it.
No. I would say both. They're physical.
Okay.
There was a physical element and there was a non-physical element. I wanted to read you something here.
All right. And while you're looking at that, for the physical contact,
okay.
How do they describe the beings that contact them?
Well, everybody had a little bit different.
Are they different species, or are they all the grays that we hear about?
No. You got to get rid of all that. You know, the grays and the whites and all the stereotypical view of extraterrestrials. We have to just let that go. And get more on a subjective experience, you know, that open up to a whole different realm of what this could be. Because these people or these beings can change their appearance to suit you. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay. So if they know you have a fear of grace, they're not going to come as a gray. You know, it depends on what kind of relationship is trying to be formed. You know, it's all part of about who we are at the same time. So there's this element of working through our own personal fear. That's a, you know, I'm trying to, you know, get back to this inner work that we need to do for ourselves so that we can make, if we're interested in making contact with these beings, that we don't have to be submissive to the fear, because I think it's going to really damage the experience.
Thomas, are we them?
Basically, yes. Now, think about this for a minute. You know, that's what I just said, I know, is a challenging and controversial answer to your question, but think about the Earth being relatively a new planet compared to all the other planets in the cosmos. You know, there could be trillions of habitable planets in the cosmos.
Oh, sure. We're in the newer one-third of the planets.
Right? What scientists tell us, we're 4.6 billion years old. Okay, now that's relatively new. Now, think about this for a minute. Now, why could not have other beings evolve on other worlds?
We think they did.
You do. Okay. So you're a step ahead. Because that's what I think is happening.
I think this is happening all over the place.
So now here's Earth. You know, in a lot of ways, we're still cave people to highly intelligent beings that have evolved maybe trillions of years ago on other planets. You know, they come here and they probably look at this as a zoo. I mean, we still kill our own species. You know, to them, that's very primitive, okay?
Well, I still think this could be the prison planet. I really do.
Yeah, but, I mean, I don't want to put us down either, because we're evolving, too. I mean, we're trying to step up to bat. You know what I'm saying? I think a lot of people are, in trying to get out of the old stereotypes that, no, I don't want to do any more violence. I don't want to kill my neighbor anymore. And what do I need to get on with this?
Well, that's true.
So we have some mentors available, I guess is what I'm trying to say, that have experienced another way of life.
I'm fascinated by the fact that most of these people who have had these experiences all seem to be enlightened. I mean, anybody say to you, oh my gosh, it scares the heck out of me, this is the end, they're going to come get us?
You know, I've been staying in contact, especially with the people in the book. You know, like I said, I probably have 100 people that have told me their experience now, but the ones in the book are kind of special because, you know, we had, you know, they were mentioned in the book. So I'm not going to say they're all enlightened people. I think that they've have an expansion of consciousness, but they still, like myself, get scared of things I'm not aware of. You know, there's still new things being learned. You know, the fear of the unknown. No, you know, I don't want to put these people up like they're these, you know, super enlightened chosen people.
I understand.
They are people like you and I. I think the main difference is that they invited something in. They asked for assistance. The historical events are so captivating. You know, in my book, I talk about the historical narratives, you know, like Orfeo and...
All right, well, we're going to talk more about this, Thomas, when we come back. We'll also take phone calls on Coast to Coast AM.